You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. This is the captain of this vessel, the Fantastic Voyage. Welcome to the Here District. My first mate, Chris Johnson, the only father and son tandem. Got to make this point here because, you know, you always got to give yourself your own flowers because other people don't want to do it all the time. The only father and son tandem to win a national championship at the same school in the NCAA, UCLA. We did it 20 years apart. And we are so, so privileged to have on today's episode a guy that I've known since he was in high school, come from the same hometown, Natchitoches, Louisiana. NBA champion, executive of the year, and now he is the guy that is responsible for the basketball operations of the NBA. He's head of everything that goes on in the NBA, Joe Dumars. Joe Dumars, welcome to Here District. Just to be able to come from Natchitoches. Now, we left Joe in 1960 when I was just 5 years old. And the first question I have for you, I grew up on 1010 Amulet Street. My dad and a couple other people helped him build that house there. And I've got some good memories, but there's also some not so good memories. It's the South. It's the early 1960s. I remember the Festival of Lights on Cane River, the Christmas parade, and Santa Claus came down the street, Joe, and there's black kids on one side. It was segregated. White kids on the other. He threw candy just to the white side of the street.
Yeah.
And Chris, there were segregated swimming pools in Natchitoches at that time. This is early 60s. Now, you are 7 years younger. What was the experience like for you? I would imagine civil rights movement things that had started to change, or maybe not. You tell me.
Some of those things stayed in place throughout my entire childhood. The two separate swimming pools. The festival got a little bit better. It started mixing a little bit better. But the South was the South, Marcus. You know how it is.
Yeah.
And so there's no sugarcoating what we had to endure to make it out of there. And I'd never try to sugarcoat it. I'm not here to make someone feel good about the trauma that we had to go through. But made it, fought through it, and you know it gave me character to get to where I am today. You know how kids are. You don't even know you're poor when you're poor. You know what I'm saying? You don't really fully understand struggle as a kid because your parents do the best they can to make your childhood as normal as possible, and that's what my parents did. They lived on the corner of Lee Street, the Amulet, right where, right down the street from where you got. Yeah, so I know exactly.
You know about Amulet, all right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, no, my childhood was, in my eyesight, it was good. It was you knew of the things, but it was abstract, Marcus. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It wasn't like front and center for you every day, but you knew it was there, and then you just went on with your childhood.
What did you rank In your family with your siblings? Were you the youngest? Were you right in the middle? Where were you at?
I'm the youngest of seven.
Okay.
I had five older brothers and one older sister. And so I was the youngest of seven. And not one person in my family played basketball. They were all football players. They used to tease me. I played football too. Yeah, right. I played football at Natchitoches Central. But they used to tease me when I started just playing basketball. They're like, "Boy, you're soft, boy. You're just playing basketball, you're soft."
Yeah. So, Chris.
You know how it is.
Yeah. Now Chris, if you want to get an understanding of Joe kind of maintaining an attachment to his roots, all you got to do is look at the mustache. See, that's a Natchitoches mustache right there. See, it is right at the corner of the lips, you know, kind of triangled down. Yeah, all my uncles and all my relatives from down there had that same mustache, man. But it had to be some competition. It had to be some fight. It had to be they had to really help you toughen up as a young man.
So, you know what? They did. And so I played football all my life, and my brothers were all excellent football players. So whatever toughness you saw that I had on the court, Marcus, it comes from that. Like, you're not going to grow up like on hard scrabble streets in Natchitoches and during that era and not come out of it with some toughness. And so whatever toughness I had, trust me, it came from having five older brothers and growing up in a tough environment of athletes.
McNeese State, So you go from Natchitoches Central to McNeese State, and man, you hit the ground running. I mean, you averaged like 18, 19 points a game as a freshman, 19 as a, almost 20 as a sophomore, then really exploded those last 2 years. Were you recruited by other schools? Were you really under the radar back then? What was it like for Joe Dumars coming out of Natchitoches Central High School, where my dad coached for about 3 or 4 years? Joe, I still run into these old heads in L.A. who played for my dad. My pastor's coach at Washington High School actually played for my dad in high school. So it's all kind of connections, small world connections. But what was it like for you from Natchitoches Central to McNeese State, and were you recruited heavily, not at all, or what was that situation like? I always wondered.
On my AAU team, my last 2 years of high school, Marcus, it was myself, Karl Malone, John Hot Rod Williams, Benoit Benjamin. All of us were on the same team. But we're country kids from Louisiana. We're just playing. We're beating everybody. But we don't even understand what it means.
Yeah.
So we get recruited by bigger schools. Carl got, I think he got recruited by Oklahoma and some other big schools. I committed verbally to Florida State. But all of us decided to, Carl decided to go to Louisiana Tech. I decided to go to McNeese State. Hot Rod decided to go to Tulane. The reason we all got together one day and we were talking, and we all said, oh, I think I can be the guy from day one. And that's what McNeese and Tech and Tulane was assuring us. And I always say to guys now, man, go where you're going to play.
Yeah.
Don't go just, you know, because it's a name. Go where they're going to put that ball in your hand and you're going to play. And it's the reason all of us went to the schools we went to. We sat around and talked like, I'm not trying to go anywhere and sit on anybody's bench or whatever. Yeah. I want the ball in my hands from day one. It's the very reason we all went where we went, Marcus.
Now, what was practices like? I mean, you got Karl Malone. You got John Hot Rod Williams, who was just an excellent power forward, by the way, 6'9", 6'10", long and athletic and tough. Benoit Benjamin, a guy who ended my career. I ran into his stomach double zeros when with the Clippers and ruptured a disc in my neck. But he was a tremendous talent out of Creighton, played for Willis Reed, another Louisiana homeboy of ours. But what was the name of the team, that AAU team? Where'd you guys practice? Where was it located out of? I mean, what were your Karl Malone? What was he like as an early Karl Malone and some of these other phenomenal players you talked about?
Yeah, we were all like 15, 16 years old at the time. One other player on the team who played for Phi Slamma Jamma for Houston, a guy named Benny Anders.
Oh, yeah. Jumping, dunking. God.
Exactly.
Now, where was he from in Louisiana? What city was he? Where was he out of?
Benny was from up around the Ruston area.
Okay.
Like up around the Ruston, Monroe area.
Right.
Up there.
Right.
And so, but practices were incredible. Like, look, we didn't know any better.
Yeah.
Like, all we knew was time to practice, go as hard as you can, compete as hard as you can, and then we all just would hang out with each other afterwards. It's a lot different AAU than it is now. We had training camp, and we were based out of New Orleans.
Okay.
So we were between New Orleans and Baton Rouge all the time, just playing, practicing, playing, and then we'd go play these national tournaments. And, Marcus, we got to the finals of like three different national tournaments. And we're just like, you know what Natchez is.
Yeah.
You know where Monroe is.
Wow.
You know where Ruston. Like, we got to national finals to all of these tournaments, man. We won one of the tournaments. I think we lost in the finals to two of them. And so we were young kids, man, just happy to be getting out of Natchez. You know.
Yeah, and who were some of the name players in those finals matchups, if you can recall it, some of the big-time players that were around at that time?
Yeah, so we played one national championship, and we played the New York team, and we played against Chris Mullins and Eddie Pinckney, who played at Villanova. So we played guys like that. One tournament we played out in Salt Lake City, Utah, and we played Alabama, we played a guy, Enos Watley.
Sure, Enimo, come on now.
All those guys.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, we traveled around the country. We would, Marcus, you remember this? Remember the magazine they used to have, Street & Smith magazine?
Sure, of course. Come on.
Okay, so we, you know, that was our internet, basically. So, you know, if we wanted to know what was happening, and we would all read about these guys. And so we'd go to these tournaments and like, oh, that's the guy we read about.
I did the same thing.
All right.
I did the same thing. Wesley Cox. I was afraid of him before I ever saw him at Louisville. So now while we're trekking here down memory lane, did you ever heard of a place called the Ape Yard, Joe? I'm sure you have.
That's where I grew up getting my hair cut.
That was the live spot in the hood, Chris. That's where your grandfather, Paul, my dad, Jeff, he was a barber, master barber for years. And I've heard so many stories about, you know, him working down in the Ape Yard and making sure he took his pistol and his razor with him down there, because it got real lively on a Friday and Saturday night.
It got real in the yard.
I can only go there during the day to get my hair cut at nighttime. Boy, don't you be down there in the Ape Yard at night.
See. And I've heard so many great stories about that, man. But so anyway, man, I could talk about this stuff all day, and especially these. I never knew that you were teammates with Benoit and Hot Rod and Karl Malone and all these great players. It's funny, when Karl Malone was a rookie, he was on the phone somewhere. Was that in Salt Lake City? He was on the phone, like, how, you know, back in those days, Chris, when we get to a visiting arena, we go to the press table and make long distance phone calls. You know, you could do it for free. And where's Malone from? He's from some. Where's he from?
He's Summerfield.
So he was on the phone. And I kind of snuck up on him, like, yeah, I know you're calling Summerfield right now, homie. He's like, what you know about that? I said, man, I'm from Natchitoches, man. I know all about that, man. So, man, yeah, but that so McNeese State, man, you were, I think, 11th. All-time leading scorer in NCAA history by the time you left out of there. Had four great years, but two really spectacular years, your last two. And I'm watching from afar. And then all of a sudden you get picked by the Pistons. And so now you're going from Natchitoches to McNeese State. What city is McNeese State? That's in
Lake Charles,
Louisiana. Mm-hmm. To the Pistons. Now, what did that mean for Joe Dumars? What did that mean for Joe, Big Joe, your dad, your mom, your brothers? What did that mean, man? To have them, you walk us through that draft process, that draft night. I know it was different back then. They didn't have the big hoopla when I was drafted. I'm not sure what they were doing when you got drafted in the early '80s. But what was that like for the Dumars family?
So first of all, everybody in my family was at work during the draft. because it wasn't that night. It was in the afternoon. It was the first time, Marcus, that they invited players to the green room. It was the first year ever. Carl and I were living in an apartment together because our senior season was over. So we were training together.
Okay.
He and I flew to the draft together. We flew to New York together. They invited like 10, 12 guys. We sat there. Draft. David Stern did the draft. Marcus, I had spoken to a couple of teams before and right after Detroit. I never spoke to Detroit. Never. Never had any conversation with them whatsoever. So I was looking at teams like Houston and Dallas and thinking, I'm going to end up there. I'd had conversations with those teams and Denver and Cleveland. I had conversations with, I don't know, half dozen teams. They were all right in the same area in the teens, early teens. And none of them, a couple of them passed. And when Detroit called my name, I was shocked beyond belief. Carl and I were sitting right next to each other. He got picked three or four picks ahead of me. And then Detroit called my name. And I was like, wow. I got up and went shook hands and all that. But Marcus, I had no idea they were going to draft me. Then I looked at their roster, and I'm like, wow, they got Isaiah Thomas, they got Vinnie Johnson, they got John Long. They're stacked at guards already. Why would they pick me? You know, I was looking at it like that. But, you know, I was happy to be picked. You know, I wasn't going to be, you know, I went there with, like, a super attitude. They're like, okay, I'm going to make this work. And so I just went there, put my head down, and just did what I always done. Like, okay. I'm going to go here and make this work. And so I went there, man, and I just went to work, man. I went to work as hard as anybody could. And I loved it, man. I did, obviously. He and I ended up forming a really good backcourt, great backcourt. And so it was great, but it was a culture adjustment for me.
Yeah.
Definitely coming from Louisiana.
When mom and dad, when they found out, when you told them, you know, first round pick, what number were you? You were top 10.
18.
What number?
18.
And so you're 18th pick in the draft. So Carl was what, 15th, 14th, 15th?
14, I
God
think.
God dang, 14 teams passed over Carl, yeah. And 17, 18 teams passed over you. Man, oh man, if we could do it all over again. Because we had, yeah. I think we drafted yeah. Benoit in that draft, Benoit Benjamin.
That you is did.
At two or three.
At two or three.
It was Ewing, yeah. Tisdale, and Benoit, yeah. or something like that.
Yeah.
But when you told... Now, I know my mother, when I got drafted third, and back in those days, Larry O'Brien, Joe, he had a big, on an easel. What are those things? A big whiteboard or something. He's writing names out.
Yep.
So it wasn't a big deal, but my mother was just, oh, Lord, I'm about to pick number three. Did you guys have a party? How exciting was that for your family? Or was it just kind of like, okay, this is just part of the process? And what was it like?
It was great. We were in New York, and Carl and I were in the back together, and he was calling home, mm-hmm. tell his family. I'm calling home. And obviously, they were super happy.
Yeah.
They were really happy. Oh, my God, that's great. You know, you're going to be going to Detroit. You're going to be living there. And they just had a bunch of questions. How does this work? When do you have to report?
Okay.
You know how it is.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Right.
So, you're just having that conversation. But they're super happy. And when I got home, we didn't have a big party, but we had a huge dinner. You know how it is at home. You know, big cookout and everything like that. So it was great.
That's a rite of passage, you know, as a basketball player, especially to be going pro.
Marcus, who went 1 and 2 in your draft?
Okay, so here's the deal. Kent Benson went number one to the Milwaukee Bucks. We traded Swin Nader.
Okay.
To the Buffalo Braves. Swin had just come off a season, Joe, where he'd averaged 15 and 14 rebounds for the Bucks. They traded him to the Buffalo Braves to get the third pick because they wanted to draft Kent number one. That was 1977. That was a year when the great white hope, and they needed they were looking mm-hmm. for a white player to come in, and corporate sponsorships were shying away. The playoff games were being shown on a delayed basis at 11:30 at night. You remember those days, man, on CBS.
Yeah.
And so and Quinn Buckner, who played with Benny at Indiana, he told me later. He told him, look, Marcus Johnson, Kent Benson. I'd take Marcus Johnson. And keeps winning later. But Nelly took Kent. And then number two was a really good friend of mine and just a great, great old-timer out of Houston, Otis Birdsong. He went number two to Kent. Yeah, he went number two to Kent. Now, so now the story with that, my teammate Richard Washington from UCLA played with the Kings. They asked Richard Washington. They had a forward by the name of Scott Webben, white guy out of Colorado. They asked Richard, who's better, Marcus Johnson or Scott Webben? He's like, man, Scott couldn't hold Marcus' jock strap. But Scott Webben, Kansas City, so they passed on me as a small forward and picked Otis Birdsong. But I have no complaints. Wound up number three with the good young team with the Milwaukee Bucks, man. So that was all good.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
Joe, growing up watching you and Isaiah and the Bad Boys against Michael Jordan, for me it was amazing mm-hmm. because we put a lot of gas on Mike back then. But when mm-hmm. he came to see Joe Dumars, mm-hmm. he wasn't the same Mike. I'm just trying to figure out what was your defensive strategy. How did you play Mike to be so effective in guarding him during that era?
I always say it's all relative in guarding. So I always make sure people know. Please know I didn't just completely shut him down. I always give people their props for that, Chris. But, Chris, I will say this, is that by far I think we were the most physical team with him, by far. And then second, me personally, and it's just my personality, and we've talked about this since, I never said a word. I never said a word to him. But I tried to go so hard at him that spoke loudly. You get what I'm saying? Like you can go real hard at a person and just look and never say a word, and they hear you. And so that was my whole thing. Like, I'm not talking. I don't need to trash talk. But I am going to go. I'm going to go knock at his heart. and so that was me. And my teammates knew that. And I had, I had some big boys behind me that were ready to rumble at the drop of a hat. And so for me, I was like, if I'm going hard out here out front, I know what I got behind me back here. All right, let's go. Let's see what happens here, you know?
Joe, as a follow-up to that, the Jordan rules. Now, was that a real thing that y'all had? Was that a real, like, philosophy and principle? Could you explain that to those of us that may not understand what the Jordan rules were?
Yeah, Chris, it was. It called it Jordan rules, but, you know, you've been around basketball all your life. Marshall, you've been around basketball all your life. It's just some certain principles where people catch the ball. It really is. At that time, early in his career, you really wanted to push him left, and so you knew – defensively, everybody stayed left. When he gets to the top of the key, make sure he goes left. If he goes right, everybody comes. You know what I'm saying? If he goes left, more than likely he's going to pull up. So it's just like tendencies, knowing where somebody's going to go and knowing when you're going to go with left. When he goes right, if you don't come hard right away, he's banging that thing. If he's going left, Chris, you don't have to come as hard because more likely to pull up and shoot it. You know what I'm saying? So it was just those type of rules. You know what I'm saying? It was a deep scouting report, Marcus. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, but... but let's not soft sell it, man, because when he went right... you said he was banging that thing. Yeah, I've seen a few highlights of some dunks on Lambeer or whatever in the open floor. But in the half court... I mean, he was getting knocked on, and we had the no layup. And Chris, we had the no layup rule, especially in the playoffs. And Nelly would say, "I'm paying all fines." He'd tell Paul McKeskey, some other big guy, Alton Lister, "I'm paying all fines. I got you." Put him on his ass. Whoever it was, he comes in the paint. Make sure that he is hesitant about coming in as aggressively again. So that's part of the Jordan rules too, right? Don't leave that out, please, Joe.
Marcus, you're absolutely right. Chris, he's absolutely right. But here's the thing, though. This is how deeply ran with us. Marcus, y'all probably did this, too. Most teams probably did this, too. If we're on defense, Marcus, Chris, if a guard passes the ball to the wing and he cuts through that lane and he doesn't get touched, we call timeouts 2 minutes into the game.
Yeah.
What are we doing tonight? Are we not playing tonight?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the timeout. Like, are we not playing tonight? They just cut through the lane twice and haven't been touched. What? So you could, Mark, you know, you couldn't even run through that lane.
Yeah.
And not get touched.
Yeah.
And so they didn't wait for you to drive with the ball. Cut through that lane if you want to. It's physical.
Yeah. One thing, Joe, that really impressed me, too, is that I heard Isaiah on an interview. And, you know, it wasn't like he was really highlighting this, but he just kind of mentioned it in passing that, you know, Joe and I were talking about our upcoming opponent. Joe and I were on the phone. It seemed like you and Isaiah had that. What was that about, man? I mean, because that wasn't, I don't know if every team had that kind of camaraderie, that kind of plug in terms of guys, your two lead guards in constant communication. Seems like you guys had that back in those days.
We did. I don't know where it came from, but we did, Marcus. Call each other on the phone. You watching this game right now? Yep. You see the last two plays? Yep. That's some good action they're running right there. We might need to take some of that. Yep. Let's make sure we do that tomorrow. We'd be on the phone half hour, 45 minutes, watching the game.
Right.
Sometimes not saying anything, just watching the game. And something happens, you go, you see that? You see what it? Yeah, I just saw that. So we sat and just, like, we talked, and then we'd get to practice the next morning. Lockers were right next to each other. Talk about the game. You've been watching this team, you've been watching Indiana play? Yeah, they run a lot of back screens. Yeah, we got to be ready for it. So, Marcus, it was constantly talking.
Well, and that explains the incredible chemistry, now that I think about it, that you and Isaiah had. But and this just leads me to a whole other topic I hadn't even thought about. But man, talk about Isaiah Thomas. When you talk about all, he gets the short end of the stick a lot, Joe. When you talk about all time point, great point guards, some of the things that Zeke was able to do, and talk about Isaiah Thomas and just how great he was, man.
So first of all time great. But second, I put Isaiah in this category. You know, Marcus, we've seen good players. We've seen really good players. We've seen great players. And then we've seen special players.
Yeah.
I put him in special.
Yep.
Like, I put him in special. Like Zeke, man, Zeke was Zeke was special on the court, man. Like, could really, really see the game and understand the whole game, what was going on the floor. It was just great being in the backcourt together and having that bond with somebody like him. Like, Zeke was special, man. Like, really special. And so, yeah, he's one of the all-time greats, yeah, man. And I'm thankful that I had a career with a backcourt mate like that. Like, at that level, that was that special. I give him all the props, man. Special player.
When did you, and maybe you always had it, but was it a moment where you realized you had to be the defensive kind of component to that basketball team? Because you were a great offensive player at McNeese State, and I'm sure you mm-hmm. played both ways. We all did back mm-hmm. in those days. But when did defense mm-hmm. become really, really important and special for you?
I came in the league in 85, mid-80s, right? The twos and the threes at that time?
Yeah.
Boy, you had your hands full.
Every night.
So, for me, it was, I can't get embarrassed.
Yeah.
So, on one hand, I know as a rookie, Zeke and Kelly Trpucca are going to take the most shots. So, I'm not going to be able to match point for point with the other two guards. So, the only way I can make it an even match is I got to lock into them.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't trying to have 10 and them have 30, Mark.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Like, for me, it was just like, I can't get out here. I can't have somebody drop 30 on me. Because I'm not going to get that many shots.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get 20 shots. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So if you get 20 and I get 10, I got to lock into you to make this an even game.
Yeah.
So that was the whole reason behind it.
Well, a thought just occurred to me. You talked about coming in as a rookie and some of the guys that were already there. And I'm just imagining in my mind, and it's maybe the furthest thing from the truth, but it seems like one guy that would really test you as a rookie would have been John Long out of Detroit. I mean, John was one of the people don't understand. Him and Sidney Moncrief, Joe, they had a fight that was a fight for the ages. And I think somebody wound up grabbing Sidney, and John hit him with a two-piece, and Sidney kind of stumbled and came back at him. But John, I would imagine, John was a trash talker, you know, especially after I went to the Clippers from the Bucks and we were bad. He'd come to L.A., hey, old man, hope you got your track shoes on. We get ready to, you know, we get ready to run y'all out the gym. I'm like, man, so you didn't talk all that when I was with the Bucks and I had some backup, you know. But what was that like being a rookie with some of those veterans back in those days?
Well, fortunately for me, those guys liked me. I was quiet. I didn't come in and talk a lot.
Yeah.
So they didn't come at me like that. And I had two guys that I had to go against every day in practice, Marcus, John and Vinnie Johnson.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. But two of the nicest guys in the world. Those guys were super, super nice to me. They were super good to me. I really like John and really like Vinny. Those guys were super nice people. But, I got to say but boy, when practice was going on, they were taking no prisoners.
Yeah, yeah.
They go at you, physical, bang you. Like, these were some grown men,
right,
as you know.
Yeah.
These weren't, you know, 18-year-old kids out there. These were grown men out there. And boy, they would go at you in practice. But two of the nicest guys ever, man. I got nothing but love for both of those guys.
Well, Vinnie Johnson, Chris, I don't know if you knew this, but he's actually my second oldest son, Josiah. King Josiah, he's his godfather. He was when
really?
Yeah.
But
it's because my ex, Josiah's mom, was best friends with a girl that Vinny was dating, and she's the godmother.
Oh, wow.
And she kind of talked him into being the godfather. So, you know, one of those situations. But we go way back to the early 80s.
Okay.
So now we fast forward now. You get into the starting lineup. You and Zeke are a tandem in the backcourt, and then you got to go through the Boston Celtics a couple of times and go through some disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was it like when you finally broke through, man, and got to the NBA Finals? Because we could never do that in Milwaukee. We ran into Bird and McHale and Parrish or Dr. J and Moses Malone and Bobby Jones and Andrew Toney and that crew.
Mm-hmm.
But what was that like, man, when you finally broke through, man?
It's I don't know if there's another team that we finally beat that there was more satisfaction from.
Yeah.
Because they were so good, Marcus. Because they seemed impossible to beat.
Yes.
You know, at a time, they just seemed impossible to beat. Like, how are you ever going to go into Boston at the Garden and beat these guys. And so finally beating those guys was might be the most gratifying series that we ever closed out, was to finally beat Boston, because they were just that good. And Marcus, what they were also was extremely smart.
Yes.
Man, I remember just like, I remember turning my head for a second or two. That's just so DJ's cutting through the lane or whatever, and I turned my head for a second, and boom, Bird, Mikhail, bam, and he's got a layup, right? And I'm just like, damn, like that. You could not make the slightest mistake with those guys. They make you pay for it. And so it was, I don't know if it was more gratifying to beat anyone else than to finally get over the hump with Boston.
Which championship? I would assume the first one, but which the first one was a sweep. Was it Lakers, Blazers?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Lakers.
Now which one? Mm-hmm. What were the emotions like for each? You walk me through that, man, for both of those.
A.C. Green fires it. Edwards clears. Last year, the Pistons had a 3-2 lead, but couldn't win one of the last two. Now they'll do it. World champs.
So Detroit must be careful. They're not playing the guy out of bounds. They're not going to allow a long pass. 0.7 seconds. There's the shot. And the game's over. And the Pistons have won the world championship. Back to back.
Yeah, so the Laker one was, we lost to them in game 7 the previous year. At the Forum.
Yes.
Game 7, lost by 3 points. Devastated.
You guys were up in the fourth quarter in that game?
We were up in the fourth quarter. Marcus, the game's over. Game 7. Me and Zeke go back in the shower area. We still got our uniforms on. The showers are not on. It's just, quiet back in the shower. We're sitting on the floor. Tears. Sitting there, just sitting on the floor, tears after game 7. Look up, standing up over us, Kareem. Pulls both of us up. We stand up, hug both of us, and say, you guys are going to be world champions. Telling you. Thanks, Kareem. And he left out.
Wow.
Zeke and I, that's all we needed to hear. That's all we needed.
Thanks, Kareem.
That summer, it was like, hey, man, okay. Yeah, we got a championship to win. So we were, you talking about on a mission going back to next season? Like, we were on a mission. Like, nah, it's got to happen.
And that was the finals MVP year for you, right? That next year
MVP.
Against the Now the Lakers were they a little banged up? I remember
they
went to training camp something and overworked themselves, hamstrings.
I think Byron Scott got hurt the first game or right before the series, and then Magic played the first two games, and then he got hurt and he went down with a hamstring. He tried to play in game 3. Yeah, he played some in game 3, but couldn't really go. But we didn't care. At that point.
That's your problem. That's your problem. Ain't got nothing to do with us. Yeah, yeah.
I got to have this one.
Okay, okay. And what did you average? You remember point with like 24, 25? I mean, you had a great offensive series, as I recall correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like 27 a game.
Dang. Okay. Who was guarding you, man? Who they try to match up on you with? No, B. Scott. It didn't matter. I'm sure it didn't matter at that time.
Coop and Worthy.
Wait a minute. You mean Hall of Fame? Hall of Fame inductee for his great defense, Michael Cooper. You're a defensive player not known for your scoring. You gave Hall of Fame defensive inductee Michael Cooper 27 in the finals, man.
It happened to work out that way.
You got to have this. All right. Next year, it's the Blazers.
And
who's on that team? Refresh our memory, because that team was loaded, man, with just some athletes.
That was Duckworth and Clyde and Terry Porter.
Was Buck on that team?
Buck Williams Buck, was on yes. that team. Jerome Kersey was on that team. I think Petrovich was on that team, too.
That's right. Yeah, young Petrovich.
Maybe he might have been on that
team. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, they were loaded.
Yeah.
I mean, they super loaded, talented team.
Cliff Robinson, Uncle Cliff, Uncle Big Cliff.
Yeah. Yep.
And that series went, what, 5 or 6? Where did that go?
5. So they split. We, Mark, if you remember, you used to do 2-3-2.
Right.
So the first two games were in Detroit, split with them. They got a win. Then we go to Portland, and we win all 3 games.
Yeah, that's right. That was crazy.
On their court.
Yeah.
Now, the first game, game 3 there, well, because I have 35, 33, 35, something like that. Come into the locker room after the game, get pulled out of the locker room. Hey, need to step out. I go to a little office, and it's my wife. She's getting ready to come out there. My dad died.
I remember that.
During the game.
Yep.
Yep. So, got a call from Nakovich on the phone with my mom. So,
How difficult was Joe? And when my dad died, March 5th, 2002, I was working for Fox Sports, covering the Pac-10, whatever it was, tournament. And I found out on like a Tuesday. He died on that Tuesday. I had to go on the air and do our first series of games like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I remember just being so immersed in the work that I was able to get through it, push through it. But then after it was all over, man, I cried. Like, you know what I mean? All the emotions came out. But just, I mean, I would imagine just you knew that Big Joe Sr. would want you to fight the battle, to finish what you had started. I mean, so what was that like for you, man? Just to show up and play so well with all that weighing on you.
You'll appreciate this. Dad has died during the game. He died first quarter of the game, something like that. And so I go back to the hotel room with my uniform still on. And this is immediately after the game. So I just put my warm-ups on over my uniform. I go back to the hotel. Before I go back, Marcus, the owner of the team, a guy named Bill Davidson, he says to me, got my jet. You can take my jet. You take it. Do what you need to do. Okay. So I go back to the hotel, Marcus, and I call my mom. I call Nakovich. And I say to him, she said, she's like, your dad held on as long as he could. I don't know. We have that conversation.
Right? Right.
So I say to her, Marcus, listen, the owner has given me his jet. This is a Sunday afternoon game, game 3. Now we are 2-1 in the series. Sunday afternoon, Marcus, and she says, I say to her, I think I'm going to fly home tonight. And she said, whoa, what you doing? What you talking about? I said, I'm going to fly home tonight. She said, for what? I said, to be home. She said, and she laughed, Marcus. She said, boy, your daddy would have a fit. He'd have a fit if you talked about leaving your job. He said, are you kidding me? She said, what would your dad say? I said, oh, my God. He would have a fit. Because, he's from that he's from that school, Marcus. Like, you ain't missing no work.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So she says, Mark, I get chills telling this story every time. So we're up 2-1 in the series. She said, when's game 4? I said, Tuesday. She said, when's game 5? I said, Thursday. She said, okay, this is what we're going to do. You're going to stay there and you're going to play game 4 on Tuesday. You're going to play game 5 on Thursday. You guys are going to win both of those games. You're going to close the series out. And then I need you to fly home Friday morning to let your dad to rest. I'm saying, like, you know how hard it is to win in the finals on somebody, to sweep somebody on their home court like 3 straight games? Like, she said that with such confidence. She wasn't saying, like, I hope you guys. She just said, here's what's going to happen.
Wow.
You're going to win Tuesday. You're going to win Thursday. I need you to be home Friday.
I'll see you Friday. Yeah.
And this is exactly how it played out, Mark.
How'd you play? How'd you play?
Marcus, I think I was averaging 29 for the first three games. And then after that, I think I averaged, like, the next two games, like, 12 or 14, yeah, 15 points.
Sure.
So it just wasn't the same.
Yeah, sure, sure. And I could imagine your teammates were aware of that. They knew they had to pick up the slack. And that kind of thing can have a galvanizing effect, too. I mean, just in terms of, you know.
Isaiah grabbed me before game four. He grabbed me in the locker room. He said, I got you. Mm. I said, you guys, I got you. Don't. God. I got you. Boy, he went to work.
Yeah.
He went to work. He went to work, man.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
And now mm-hmm. we segue, we move on to you as an executive. You retire, I believe, mm-hmm. in 99, right around that point.
Yep.
There was
mm-hmm.
That was the strike year, right, if I'm not correct. That was
yep.
the 50
yep.
games
yep.
And that, the Spurs-Knicks, I believe, mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. finals that year. But you retire, and was being an executive something you'd always thought about? How soon did that happen for you? How did that process unfold?
Never thought about it. No plans to do it. Wasn't even a thought. I had two companies here in Detroit, businesses outside of sports. And the middle of my last season plan, owner sends me a note. After I'm practicing. Me, Grant Hill is my teammate yeah. then. And Jerry Stackhouse is my teammate. You know, I got some young guns yeah. on my team, right? So after practice one day, got a note on my desk. Owner wants you to call him up. Hey, can you stop by? Can you stop by my office, which is right next door to where we practice? Sure, I'm going to jump in the shower and then I'll come over. He said, how many more games you got? I said, we're about halfway through, about 25 more games. He said, okay. He said, I got a proposition for you. I said, okay, what's up? He said, I'd like for you to take over, president of the team.
Mm.
I said, while I'm playing tomorrow? What? I said, I got a game tomorrow. What are you talking about? He said, nah, as soon as the season's over, I want you to take over. He said, what do you think? I said, well, I can't say yes to that right away. I'd have to think about that. I said, you know, I got businesses. I got a young family, my wife, my two kids. And I've never thought about doing this. The first time he and I have ever talked about it was it. Long story short, talked to my wife about it. She said, I think you'd be great at that.
Mm.
Thought about it. Got back with him and said, okay. And Marcus, if he doesn't call me over and proposes that, it never happens.
Mm.
I never stay in front office position. I move on. I had supplier. I was a tier two supplier to automotive, the GM Ford, Chrysler, Toyota.
Okay.
And so so I was all set to just stay in that sector of business and be done with my yeah. playing career. So I never pursued it. And if he doesn't call me, I know for a fact I never get in it. I never go there. So it was one of those situations where he saw something and said, I think you could be great at this.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing it for 15 years.
And did a tremendous job. Executive of the Year in 2003, mm-hmm. NBA Champion 2004. And you brought mm-hmm. Chauncey Billups into mm-hmm. the fold. And what's funny, mm-hmm. Joe, what's interesting is that, so I'm hanging out at UCLA that summer before Chauncey goes mm-hmm. to the Pistons. And mm-hmm. I see Chauncey all summer long. I introduce myself to him. He's killing the pros mm-hmm. out at UCLA. I'm not playing. I'm just watching. Mm-hmm. I go up to mm-hmm. Chauncey. I'm like, man, you know, I didn't know you was this good, blah, blah. After the Boston mm-hmm. fiasco with Rick Pitino and that whole thing mm-hmm. coming out of Colorado. I go on the air at Fox Sports with Kevin Frazier, and we're talking about mm-hmm. the upcoming NBA season. I'm saying, and I say the guy to keep your eye on this season is Chauncey Billups. Mm-hmm. So Kevin Frazier's like, Chauncey Billups from Boston? He's garbage. What do you mean? I'm mm-hmm. telling you, I saw him down at UCLA. What did you see in Chauncey, man, that made you feel like he could be a crucial part to what you were trying to do in with the Pistons?
Sometimes it's when you get a player.
Yes.
That's most important. Marcus, he got drafted over Boston. He played 5 years in the NBA. He played for five different teams that had been traded five times.
That's right. Toronto, ball. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yes.
Minnesota, Orlando. He five different teams, traded five times, and now he's a free agent. And I signed him to the full mid-level at the time, which was, for him, incredible money, like right. $6 million a year. And he was in Minnesota that final season, coming off the bench behind Terrell Brandon.
Wow.
And two things that I learned running teams for 15 years is this, is that sometimes you got to get a guy at the right time where he can hear you.
Yes.
So Chauncey said to me, he said, you know, when I was a rookie going to Boston, I just thought it was going to happen automatically. I just thought, oh, okay, I'm the third pick and I'm going to be great. He said, I had no idea how hard it was going to be, Joe. Yeah. So at that point, you know, a young guy may not be able to hear you. But I knew after 5 years, five different teams, traded five times, he can hear me now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But one. Yeah. Two is, has he kept his confidence? Because sometimes that'll kill a guy's confidence. Yeah. Sometimes guys can't come back from that. I could tell he was still confident. So he had the talent, Marcus. I knew he could hear me. And I knew he had kept his confidence. So for me, I looked at it and went, this is a guy worth taking a bet on here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just stuff you look for
right.
when you run these teams. It's just certain it's certain things that have to be in place for you to take a chance on certain guys.
So you didn't look at a whole analytical breakdown in terms of his shot quality and points per possession on
that,
this?
That was my analytics right there. I analyzed what I need to analyze. That was my analytics right there, Bob.
And I love that. That's a perfect segue because people may not know, but it's a lot of Bucks who in management that have come through or out of the Joe Dubar school of general managering. So we got who? John Horst, Ryan Hoover, John Hammond. Yeah. I mean, talk about some of these guys in their infancy in terms of management and what you thought of them and what you were able to provide for them in terms of your insights.
And also, don't leave out Darvin Ham, who was a player here.
Okay.
He was on my championship teams here, too.
Wow, I forgot about Darvin Ham. Okay.
Yeah, so one of the things I think, if you talk to any of those guys, they would tell you that one of the things I emphasize to all of them for years is that the minute you try to get away from the human element of this thing, you're going to be making a mistake. These are humans. These people have emotions, ups and downs, and if you can't tap into the human element of a guy, I don't know if you can get his best.
Yeah.
And so he's not a widget. You know, he's not, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, he's just not this product.
Right.
And so make sure that you understand, because I always say to guys this, and John Horst and all these guys will tell you this. I always said to guys, and I said to them when they were young, Hammond and all these guys, said to them, remember something. When he signs that dotted line, or when you trade for him, or when you draft him, understand that two people are walking in your building, the player and the person.
Mm.
The player may have this incredible skill, but if the person is a cancer to your team or a cancer to your environment, that's going to overshadow the talent.
Right.
So you better know, don't just come and tell me he can really run and jump high and he can make 7 out of 10 shots. I always would ask him, who's the person?
Yeah.
Who is he? So it's that type of stuff that I always try to impart upon those guys is that, man, there's always two people walking in that door, the player and the person. And so those are some of the key things
right.
that we live by, you know, and those guys, you know, they were part of that for years with me.
Yeah, and I would see a lot of that in the guys that we picked up to kind of, they say on the margins, I kind of hate to use that impersonal kind of kind of connotation, but you know what I'm saying. But Gary Trent Jr. seems to be the epitome of that same type of a guy who I think has enormous potential, Joe, and just, you know, he wanted the big, I don't know, whatever the situation was, but we got him, you know, for whatever the minimum or whatever it was. But knowing when to get a guy, knowing when a guy is trying to prove himself, when he's, you know, when he's at that point, he's at that make or break point in his own mind, right?
Absolutely. And those are the guys, when you're putting teams together, when you're running a team, it's those type of things that you that have to be a part of how you do business. It can't be the only part, but it has to be a part. You have to be looking for one or two guys like that, that your staff and people are looking at.
Yeah.
Who is that guy? And your staff may come to you and say, Marcus, here's three guys I think fit that profile that we're talking about. Let's take a look at these three. So you have to look for guys like that at all times, Ross. You really do. One other guy that's in Milwaukee that's got some Detroit ties. I drafted Chris Middleton.
Oh, yes, right. Okay, second round. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about all the Detroit ties there with Milwaukee.
Yeah. One of the few second rounders to be an All-Star. I mean, and that was so you saw something obviously in him. That...
He was hurt. He was hurt when he was coming out. He had a knee injury.
Okay,
and he had an ACL or something, right? And so everybody was like, he's got ACL. I said, yeah, but did you see him when he was a freshman before he got his
ACL? Right.
Like, yeah. I was like, okay, so did you see how good he was before?
Yeah.
So I was looking at him before he got hurt and saying, okay, well, if he gets healthy, that's the player you're going to get right there. So for a second-round pick, you know, I thought you absolutely have to take him. He's a first-round talent.
Yeah. So now, Joe, let's talk about your current – responsibilities now in the league office, man, and you know the I think the best thing that you've done, and it impacted us, the Bucks, negatively at least a bit around January, February. But Dame Lillard was shooting about 9 free throws a game. Every time he'd get that little touch foul, he'd get 2 free throws. Well, he went down from 9 free throws a game to like 5 after February or something last year. But man, you know, I just like the fact you tell me. I mean, what's your thought process in terms of defense and bringing kind of defense back into the NBA?
So, a couple of things I would say. This is so Marcus, I'm in touch with all 30 teams, whether it be owner, GM, coach, player, whoever. To a man, it was, man, we like the change.
Yeah.
My point was this, is that if you allow the defense to just hammer the offense, that's an imbalance in the game. It's an imbalance in favor of the defense. If you allow the offense the ability to have such an advantage, that's an imbalance to the game. The only thing that we did was this, and I can break it down simple. Marcus, what was happening was offensively, you could be sliding with me, and you're on defense, and I'm driving.
Yes.
And I lunged into you, Marcus, and I was getting 2 free throws.
Yeah.
I thought that was imbalanced. I thought, and I got these calls, Marcus, from these plays, and maybe a guy got a tech because of the play, or head coach would call, and they would go, and fairly they would say, what is my guy supposed to do?
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do? And we simply said, we cannot reward the offense for lunging into the defense with 2 shots.
Yeah.
That was the change right there. That was it. It wasn't like we allowed the defense to start hammering you or anything like that. We just said it's unfair to the defense. Slide, slide, slide. A guy lunges into you and you give him 2 free throws. And that was the adjustment in the middle of the season.
Well, and you'll be happy to know that Monty McCutcheon, the supervisor of officials, did a great job breaking that down for all the broadcasters recently, talking about the straight line pathway that defenders are allowed to.
That's
basically,
it.
If you cut a guy off to the spot, you ought to be allowed to cut a guy off. Joe, I'm watching. So we pick up Gary Trent Jr., Taurean Prince. So I pull up all their defensive possessions on Synergy. And I can't tell you how many times once the offensive player starts to penetrate, they open up and just allow him to go by because that foul situation is in their mind. It has a psychological effect on being able to play tough defense without hands and physicality and bumping, but just staying in front of a guy. That was leaving the game, and that's a travesty, man.
Marcus, what it does is it hurts the competition.
Yeah.
You can't compete like you need to compete.
Yep.
When you have to worry that I got to open up, then in turn people say, oh, these guys don't want to play defense. No, the guy's trying to stay out of foul trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Allow him to compete and don't penalize him. If he's slide and he's there and the offense lunges into him, you can't penalize that defensive player. And then when he stops doing it, then turn around and say, oh, he doesn't want to compete.
Right.
Yes, he does.
Right.
You have to allow the guy to compete, and that's what changed. That was it. Monty does a great job of explaining this as well. But that was a change, Marcus, in the middle of the season right there.
Yeah, well, I think a change that was I think it's going to benefit. You just mentioned it. Just the perception, because you hear a lot of people say, "Oh, they play no defense in the NBA, and the league has legislated the ability to play defense, you know, out of the hands of the defensive player. You're bringing it back. Nobody better to do it than you, 6-time All-Star, 5-time All-NBA defensive player, Hall of Famer Joe Dumars, man. Mm-hmm. Look, man, I know you got a lot of stuff to get into. We appreciate it so much, you coming to by here, District, to spend a little time with us, my Natchitoches homeboy. And, let's do it again sometime, man, because there's just so many great stories to tell, and I just appreciate it, man.
No, I appreciate you guys, man. I appreciate you. Appreciate Chris. I'll say it again. The first motivation I got in my life was cousin Daryl Johnson and my cousin Marcus Johnson. For me in Natchitoches, you know, I'm a big proponent of you kids have to be exposed to something.
Yes.
I was exposed to the idea that somebody from Natchitoches went to UCLA and then went to the NBA and was a star player in the NBA. For me, I was like, oh, my God, man. Like, so I'm just telling you, man, like, I'm telling you, Marcus, man, like, I always say that about young kids, but you never know what young kid you're going to impact, man. And that was me as a young kid growing up in Natchitoches, hearing about you.
Well, I'm glad God brought our paths together, man, and just keep up the good work. You're just a, you know, just a terrific role model of everything good about this sport of ours, and I've just had it's just been a marvelous journey for me just watching you, just watching all the great things that you're doing,
it.
Man. And just keep doing
Thank
it, man.
You.
All right, Joe Dumars, here on the Here District, man. Appreciate you.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.